Good afternoon, everybody. This is Barb Pello. I'm a group director at InfoTrends, and I'm delighted that you could join us today for a value-added pricing strategy. We're not the cheapest, but. And to frame the discussion today, we're all dealing with a highly competitive production printing marketplace. And it can be very, very difficult for you to persuade customers to buy from you if there's a perception that you offer similar products to competitors, but with a higher price tag. Today, what you're going to hear about is service providers that are focusing on the real value that they deliver to customers to attract and build a loyal customer base. I think what you'll see is that there's a reason that people buy designer label clothes and luxury cars, and that reason is the perceived value of what's being delivered. Today, I'm joined by three people that I consider to be experts in terms of understanding how to price for the value they deliver. Scott DuBois, President of Padalia, is with us, Scott Feldman, Chief Strategist from Progressive Solutions, and Val DiGiacinto, President of Val DiGiacinto and Partners. Now, before we get started, what I do want to do is make sure I give you a couple of tips to enjoy today's webinar. First of all, if you're having any technical difficulties, you need to let us know by using the Q&A box, or you can troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget below. If you have a question for today's speakers, you can submit those via the Q&A box. We'll be taking questions throughout the webinar, so as you key them in, I'll try and make sure that we ask them of our panelists. Make sure you disable those pop-up blockers. And to see what the console can do, you can click on the Tips for Attendees widget for a complete rundown. Now, let me spend just a minute taking you through our agenda. I'm going to spend just a couple of minutes talking about how to price. And then what you're going to be hearing from are Scott DuBois, Scott Feldman, and Val DiGiacinto about how they're doing it. We'll wrap up with some final thoughts. And as I indicated, we'll be taking questions throughout the webinar. Now, when you think about your pricing strategy, what you want to do is understand if you've got the right price. A small increase or decrease can dramatically affect business. If you price too low, you create the perception that you're less professional. If you charge too much, people think that you're greedy. But the big message that you'll hear today is that you have to transform your price into real value, whether it's increased response rate, it's helping your client protect their brand, it's increasing the lifetime value of a customer, it's enhanced support to dealer channels, or it's an increased average order size. Your price needs to be designed to achieve the financial goals of the company. It's got to fit the market realities and a clear understanding of what price customers will buy at. It's got to support the product's positioning and the marketing mix. And it's influenced, by the way, by the type of distribution channel, types of promotion, location, convenience, and quality of the products and services. Now, there's a number of different strategies out there. Some people do cost plus, loss leader, contribution-based, penetration. But I think what you'll hear is that the most important strategy is pricing on value add. And when you think about value add, I tell everybody that from a print service provider perspective, you could learn a lot from New York City street vendors selling umbrellas. The savvy sellers understand that their customer base and the price that they're willing to pay based on the value received. At the first hint of rain, what those vendors do is they double their umbrella prices. It has nothing to do with cost. It's about the increased value that customers place on the availability of staying dry in a thunderstorm. And I think what you've got to look at if you're a print service provider is this story's got a moral. And that is that the insight of the fluctuating value of an umbrella is not just relevant to street vendors. It's applicable to every company in the world. In a recession, there's increased value associated with return on marketing investment. And what that means is that you're going to have to be able to clearly articulate the value proposition into perceived customer value. Even minor features, things like rush jobs, that may not cost you much more to offer, are like a thunderstorm cloud in the horizon. They signal that customers are willing to pay more for the value that you deliver. Now, what you're going to get are three very different perspectives because we've got three companies with different business models. The first that I'm going to turn over to is Scott Dubois. And Scott's going to share with you a more agency-oriented perspective, and he's going to take you through what they're doing at Padalia. And so with that, Scott, take it away.
Great. Thank you so much, Barb. And let me tell you guys a little bit about Padalia first. We are an advertising agency, so maybe a little bit of a different business model than some of you folks who are on the call, but certainly we deal in a lot of the spaces that you deal with in terms of multi-channel marketing and have a lot of experience in terms of how we package these programs and how we position ourselves appropriately to our client base. So at Padalia, we have five areas of expertise, and it's creative, media, interactive, direct marketing, and social. Within our creative group, we feel that we treat creative a little bit differently, and that it's not just the design group, right? The copywriting group, and even the engineers take part in our creative teams because we want to identify potential obstacles or make sure that anything that we're envisioning can actually happen and we don't get ourselves hiccuped a little bit later on down the line. Media is specifically how we deal with channels, and that could be print, that could be outdoor, it could be television, it could be radio, but we think of media as its own standalone business unit, and interactive is certainly our busiest and most growing segment of what we deliver. A segment that we deal a lot more with right now is social and how we tie those programs into traditional marketing, and I'm going to talk more about that in a little bit. But that continues to grow. Obviously, everyone's involved in that. And then I certainly know that everyone on the call today deals in direct marketing, certainly with the advent of variable data and your digital press capabilities. We're seeing more and more demand for clients for better results in our direct marketing efforts. So let's talk about how this applies to our day-to-day. First and foremost, media is just storage and transmission that's used to share information. And so I think a focus that we have that's applicable to everyone that's on the call is that we don't want to think about what we offer in terms of different components. So let's say we're going to do a campaign for a client, and it's going to have some direct mail component, some web component, some email component. That's all well and good, but we don't want to take those services and break them out. You want to have that as a bundle. So we don't want to think about media as different price points. Media just helps you get that message out there. The value certainly isn't in the channel. The value is in the thoughts and the ideas and how you tie these things together. We want to make sure that we understand the shift that's going on between traditional media and new media, right? We like to think of it, the analogy we use is you know, using both hands. You're going to have a much better grip on what's going on. So it's not about trending toward one versus the other. There's certainly a lot of traditional media that's having a great result, and certainly those folks on the call that have offset presses, you know, and are using offset in combination with digital. That's one example of you can find, you know, using the right tool for the right job. We firmly believe in using an approach that has both hands involved. For us, it's all about using the right tool for the right audience. So first and foremost, is as we price and as we talk about, and I the thing I like to talk about is that pricing happens from the first time you meet a prospect or first time you meet with a client for a new opportunity, right? And so it's about how we think, and that sets the stage for how we're going to price something. So the right tool for the right audience. So we would never sit down with a client and start to talk about, well, you know, in our business, the thing you'd always see is, well, you know, we're going to have a television outreach, we're going to have a radio buy, and there's going to be a direct mail component, and it's, you know, spray and pray, and we're not an agency that thinks like that, okay? So we're thinking immediately, right at the outset, about how we're going to segment, how we're going to have research, how we're going to be able to use surveys and other sort of data tools to make sure that the media that we select is applicable to their audience, okay? So we're going to be really intelligent about that. And the perception of you as a company starts right from the get-go. So really be thinking about things. Try not to think in general terms. Try to really think about how you're going to break things down and how you're going to provide value right from the get-go, okay? And what we really do is we want to leverage existing and emerging technologies, right, to tell a compelling story and drive sales. Oftentimes, I think the point that is lost as we put things together, right, and as we write proposals or lines of business is all about the production, and we tend to get too production-oriented and not thinking about the goals, right, which is to tell a story, to evoke an emotion, and then drive sales or, you know, increase enrollment or whatever it is for the particular business case. But we need to make sure that as we're pitching and then as we're writing proposals and ties to price, that we identify those business goals, right? And it doesn't just become so production-oriented in what we're doing. So the focus needs to be on the client, data, and accountability, right? Don't be scared of that. Certainly, we never guarantee results. I think a lot of times folks that get into that, it's kind of a snake oil salesman. But you want to have accountability, right? You want to identify those objectives and make sure that you can measure them, okay? Because it's okay to be wrong, but you just want a sense of why that is so that you can recalibrate focus and then launch again. So really don't be scared of accountability. We actually write, you know, accountability and measurement into our, you know, agreements, which we'll talk about in a little bit. So let's talk about, all of that being said, how we build a pricing model. You know, first and foremost, especially from the print industry, and I have a lot of experience, that's where I spent many years, forget everything that you think you know about pricing, okay? So in the print world, a lot of times we like to say, well, you know, this is high value added, if you will, right? And so we'll analyze our costs. We'll say, well, we have some fixed costs to execute a campaign, and certainly we have, let's say it's a high value add campaign, a lot of creative or database work or whatever it is, right? And we want to make some money. So we're going to look at that and maybe even have some sort of a markup. And I wouldn't speculate what that markup is. And that's what you're going to sell it at. The only consideration being what it costs me to produce the project. So first I'd recommend just forget everything you think that you know about pricing to sell these high-level projects, okay? The analysis, what you really want to focus on to come up with your price, is what you're going to do for your client, how you're going to improve their process, what efficiencies are you going to create, what kind of results are you going to drive, okay? The focus isn't on your resources. So if you're able to bring something to market that, let's say, speeds a product to market, lets them input their data in a clean way and eliminates handwork, that lets them handle enrollments in an automated fashion, that lets them reach out to a more targeted audience and therefore increase response rates, that's what you want to focus on. And if you reach, if you remember a few minutes ago we talked about business objectives, you want to have your pricing line up with those business objectives, okay? And then, to my third point here, you can begin to sell based on perceived value. I'll give you an example, one I like to use often. So we did a campaign for a client whereby we proposed, it was an integrated print and some interactive components, but at the end of the day, what they were able to do in terms of efficiencies was remove 8 temp workers that they had that did this project every day. Now, that was an ongoing course of, you know, business that they had that was different companies they worked with, but they had these 8 temporary workers every day in their office handling the input of this data that we changed in an automated fashion. So beyond the cost of that, we eliminated the cost of data entry, where oftentimes there were errors. And furthermore, we did some personalization, and we increased their response rates a little bit over 5% from what they were getting currently. So there was some tremendous value. Now, one thing that I can tell you is if we had priced this just based upon what it cost us to produce it, we would have sold this for about 1/100th of what we actually did sell it for. So we did the analysis in terms of what it was worth to the end client, and we built those business objectives. We outlined what we hoped to achieve, and therefore we could attach the appropriate price tag to the project. So really think about perceived value and not so much what it's going to take you to produce the project.
Scott, before you move on, I've got a quick question from the audience. And Scott, the question is, how do you get at that data with a client? I mean, you could see the 8 temp workers, but how do you get the client to share with you what acceleration of time to market for a new product is worth? How do you get that data from the client, or how do you help build that perception with the client?
Sure. Well, I can tell you with any of our clients, and certainly when we meet with a prospect as well, the first thing we do with the prospect is sign a non-disclosure agreement, because it's not fair to either party, Barb, to go into this blind. So first and foremost, you deal with the non-disclosure, okay, and you have that signed. And those are things that the client should have prepared. By the way, if they're not prepared and they need assistance, we're willing to help them do that for a price. But you'll find more often than not the client knows these types of things, because you want to be able to, beyond, you know, thinking a little bit, quote-unquote, greedy, if you will. Beyond just thinking about what I'm going to charge for it, how can I ever write an agreement that's going to accurately describe what we're trying to achieve without those data points? So you need, don't be scared by any means to ask your client or your prospect for those data points. It's something that happens up front. There's discussion that happens, and one of the things you're going to do is try to validate that as well, right? You want to validate it to make sure, one, it's accurate, and two, when you identify those objectives, to figure out if it's realistic. So those are the things you want to think about in terms of how you get that data from the client. But it's something you should not be scared to ask for. It's readily out there if you ask for it.
Great. Thanks, Scott.
You got it. So you want to make sure that as you write these agreements, you work with terminology that your clients know and will appreciate. So get to know their business, the way they think. You know, acronyms, everybody these days, it seems, has acronyms for everything. Make sure that you get and you become conversant in the way that they speak, and you want that to be reflected in your agreement. And then you want to think about how you're going to price these types of services versus your traditional services. We already talked about it's a completely different mindset. By the way, when you have an all-inclusive campaign, right, which is the ideal world, where you have some sort of cross-media services that then blend and transition over to print services, because we're bundling these, right, not treating them as a line item, like we talked about, media channels are just a tool. They're not the value of what you bring. You should be able to charge appropriately and capture the value that your print brings to market. Don't be scared to do that. And then the biggest thing is you want to think about schedule and deployment of these campaigns. Oftentimes, or any time I can tell you, it doesn't happen as quickly as print can happen. So you want to make sure that because it's addressed in your agreement, and we're going to talk about the structure of an agreement here on the next slide, that you can accurately project what it's going to take and that you can live up to your agreement to deliver these types of campaigns. And then you need to balance that manufacturing and creative process because it is two different schools of thought. So let's talk about what an agreement should look like. And this is something that I see all too often mishandled. You'll see some folks call it a contract. You'll see some folks call it a proposal. But the legal word of art that you want to be structuring with your clients is an agreement. And I can tell you this from a lot of years of experience. You know, way back when, we weren't doing this right. And if you are not friends with your attorney, you want to become good friends with your attorney. A lot of times folks are put off by that, right? They're scared, you know. Only if things get bad do I want to invoke that. I can tell you that probably 70% of our agreements are reviewed by our attorney before they go out. It's an important line to make sure that you cross. So let's talk about what this agreement should look like. This is the structure of how we structure it. It covers everything, and I'll talk about these segments individually. The first is an introduction letter, and it's just what it sounds like, but it's not the overview. It really talks about the opportunity, past successes, if it's an existing client, and where you look to go in the future. The overview talks about the specific engagement that this agreement covers, and you want it to be conversational in nature, right? There's it should be easy for somebody to read. Very often, I can tell you, our clients tell us this overview is what gets passed around to make sure everyone's on track. So the overview is the conversational representation of what you're going to deliver. The components is probably one of the two most important things that are on this. So you want to make sure that every deliverable is outlined within the component and what is included in that. So if it's a digital print piece, you want to make sure that you talk about size. You want to make sure that you talk about stock. You want to make sure that you talk about quantity. If it's a microset experience, you want to make sure that you talk about scalability. You want to make sure that you talk about how the data is handled. You want to make sure that you talk about redundancy. You want to make sure that everything that happens, every business process and technical component of it gets outlined there. All too often, we're scared to put responsibility onto our clients, and it's just not fair. A relationship needs to be beneficial for both parties. And so you need a section that talks about client responsibilities. And this covers everything from as simple as presenting, making sure that they give you their current brand usage guidelines, to designating folks who have stakeholder part of the agreement and folks who are final decision makers. Because the last thing that you want to be getting into is a turf war. And we've seen it happen. We put this clause into agreements, and we still see it happen. What you need is that agreement to turn around and point to. So make sure that you put some responsibilities for your client. And then you'll have a wireframe, which is nothing more than a drawing of all functionality and all dependencies of a project. So make sure that you have a wireframe there. And make sure that you outline terms and price separately. Right? Terms cover everything from who owns the intellectual property to how many design concepts you're going to cover to how you handle reporting, where the jurisdiction is and in which state, who owns the data, what happens if somebody wants to terminate early. Make sure all of that is outlined in your terms. And then the price is presented as a single line item, just one. Make sure you don't break that out. The whole bundle is the value that you're bringing. And then finally, there's the agreement where everybody signs. And so it gets to be a pretty hefty document, but this is what we do for every single one of our campaigns, and it makes sure that both parties are protected. With that, my presentation is finished.
I have a couple quick questions for you before
sure.
we turn it over to the next Scott.
Yeah, if I could jump in, Barb, one of the things I'd love to share with everyone, somebody in our business who I think illustrates this very eloquently, and it's a book I'd recommend for everyone on the call, is a book called Design is a Job by Mike Montero. And some of these components he gets into a lot deeper, but I think certainly in my business, and it's very applicable to the print business, about how you handle things, how you write agreements, how you deliver value to what you're doing every day. It's I'll tell you, it's one of the best 10 books I've read in the last year, so I'd recommend it to everyone on the call. And with
Great.
That, go ahead, Barb, with your question.
Okay, I have two quick questions for you, Scott, and then I'm going to turn it over to the next Scott. But could you just give an example, a high-level example of the range or the percentage of margin you can make? So if it cost me $50 to do, but it had high value, what you could charge for it. Could you kind of give a compare, just a general range of some of the margins that you've achieved?
Yeah, so I'll use the example you and I were talking about 3 weeks ago on that call we had. So we had an opportunity, and I had gone over it with Barb just so everyone can know, and I kind of did the analysis. I was on a call with Barb and Matt, and we were talking about this whole idea of perceived value. And what they asked me to do was calculate what it cost me to produce the project so that we could arrive at the difference for what we sold it for. So I did the calculations. I figured web developers at $175 an hour, designers at $115 an hour, copywriters at $100 an hour, media consulting at $150 an hour, and I just used the standard rates from our agreement. And we did all the math, and it came out to the production of this particular campaign would have been, I think it was $18,750, somewhere in that range. And we ended up selling the project for $66,000. So if I, that's a real great example for you right there. If you think about just selling, your hourly rates, or even thinking that you can take your hourly rates and double them and get it something that's anywhere realistic, it's not there. You really need to analyze what it's worth to the client and not just figure that out. So, the best example is the one that we kind of did on the phone a couple weeks ago.
Okay. And one last question. I think I know your answer to this, but what happens if the client is using a bid process? So they don't allow the engagement conversation. What do you do?
We walk away. Absolutely hard and fast rule. I refuse to get into a bidding situation. It's crazy, and it's not fair to either party, and I refuse to do business if it's not fair to both folks.
Great. I knew that was what you were going to say, but I thought I'd test it. Now, with that, what I'm going to do is, and again, this is going to be a very different business model, I'm going to turn over to Scott Feldman from Progressive Solutions, and he's going to share with you their strategy and go-to-market and how they price projects at Progressive Solutions. Scott, take it away.
Thanks, Barb. Good morning from the Pacific time zone. My name is Scott Feldman, and I co-own Progressive Solutions. The company was started in 1990 by Mark Sarpa and myself. We were in Mark's spare bedroom of a two-bedroom apartment, and 22 years later, we're now 60 people operating in 38,000 square feet, and we run 24 hours a day. We're based in Santa Clara, California. Our focus is on digital printing with a concentration in personalization, automation, technology around web to print, and what we call private label or white label manufacturing. Uh, Over the years, Progressive Solutions has kind of gone from a company name to more of a holding company because we've produced three different brands in our history. PrintHQ is our legacy brand. It really means Progressive Solutions, but it's the domain for Progressive Solutions. Stationery HQ is around specifically around the stationery market, and Frecklebox is personalized gifts for kids. And so we find ourselves playing in B2B, B2B2C, and B2C. Sorry, I just had a slide delay there. Frecklebox is our B2C offering. It's personalized gifts for kids. This site uses three distinct web-to-print technologies that get commingled into one website offering. And you can see the breadth of product down the left-hand side here. The vertical nav is extensive and wide. Stationery HQ is targeted at the professional design market. And this is specifically for the stationery market. And when I say stationery, I don't mean letterhead and business cards. It's more of the greeting card market, if you will. So weddings, birth announcements, any type of event where it requires an invitation or announcement or a holiday card, for example. On this site, we do not supply any designs. This site is strictly a templated site that we are the back-end fulfillment for. So all the designs are provided by the people on the site, and no designs are provided by Stationery HQ. PrintHQ, like I said, is more of our traditional legacy work. It's typically a web-to-print portal that we've done for a corporate client. Occasionally we do straight POD, but it's not a big part of our business. So if it doesn't have some complexity to it involving either VDP or web-to-print complexity, we tend to shy away from that type of traditional work. Some of our strengths, we feel like we have a great technology stack, which leads to automation for us. We have four on-staff IT folks with several outsourced partners as well. We are the largest digital printer, I believe, in the San Francisco Bay Area in terms of capacity. We're big enough to take on some large work, but we're small enough to remain flexible. So we're not the type of company that says, you know, you have to do this type product A and it goes down this line and it must be done this way every time. Although we do that for certain segments of our market, we are open to new products and bringing on new ideas. We like to invest in new technology, whether that be equipment, process. It doesn't really matter, any technology for us. We always want to be on the leading edge there. We are an innovative company, or at least we think we're an innovative company. That's kind of my role here. So we, again, are trying to come up with product or process that is a little bit different or outside the box from the way things are done on an everyday basis. I've got great leadership. Some of you may know the CEO. His name is Mark Sarpa, and he's heavily involved in the D-Scoop and on the D-Scoop board. Our general manager is Jim Toll, and he's been with us for 15 years, so he knows the place like the back of his hand. So we're very fortunate to have the leadership we have. We've got loyal employees. They're great employees. They like to work here. We've got an ownership thinking program that we think is great, and it keeps them here and keeps them happy. And our owners are actually, myself and Mark, are both recovering accountants, so we do like to think that we understand the financial picture. In terms of value add for our for our product offerings, we typically think of it as automation. Whatever we can take and do it better, do it more efficiently, more effectively, that's kind of where we shine. The transactional work represents a very small portion of our work, maybe 5%, and that's more for our legacy clients, the ones that we've had for, say, 5+ years or so. The process work is typically driven by web portals. If it's not our web portal, it is the customer's web portal, and we're simply the back end manufacturing for that. We feel like the automation, the technology allows us to be great and consistent in meeting or exceeding SLAs. And if you're going to keep customers happy and loyal, meeting and exceeding the SLAs that you've set forth is critical to that. So whether that be a quality issue or a service issue or a customer service issue or turnaround times or pricing or whatever, as long as you can meet or beat those expectations, your customers are going to be very loyal. We do have a wide range of product as well as a wide range of offerings in the IT area. We like to think that if the web-to-print solution is a simple one, we can do it, but it's not really where we shine. The more unique, the better for us. A good example of that would be last year we did a web-to-print build where the customer wanted the entry point into the store to be from three different sources. One, they could log in directly. Two, they could log in from their intranet. Or three, they could log in from their Salesforce login. So it took a lot of work, not only on our side, but on their side as well, working back and forth to get these points of entry to basically give them the same result when they got inside the site. Pricing philosophies. This is, for us, it's kind of a twofold. One is technology is not really viewed as a profit center for us. It's used more as a acquiring tool. We certainly charge, and we want to make a buck there if we can. But we try to price it as fairly and competitively as we can in order to enable the print engines, which is what we feel is our core, and have them running all the time. So we use technology to acquire print. One thing I should talk about is web portals. I believe Scott already mentioned this in his agreement scenario that he was doing the review for. The web portals are, you really do need to scope it out and be very specific with what you're going to do, what the customer is going to do. It is very rare that the original estimate on a web-to-print build is actually the final cost, and that's due to scope creep. What typically gets scoped is about 80% of what's really going to happen, and neither side can really predict scope creep, as each time it tends to be different depending on what you're doing for the customer. In terms of regular billing, we do charge for site services or hosting services, and that's on a declining scale based on the print volume. The more you print, the less we need to capture revenue in the IT area. So I think this title here that I put here, "Look at Market Pricing, but Don't Use It as a Guide." I don't know what I was thinking there. It's okay to use it as a guide. What I'm trying to say is, don't let it dictate your pricing. Just because somebody's selling a book for $29.99 doesn't mean you have to sell a book for $29.99. I think you need to be within reason if you have a like product. But if your product is unique, or your story is unique, or your service is unique, you set the pricing based on what it's worth to the customer. So it's important as a guide, but it shouldn't rule what your pricing is. Again, commodity-driven products for us, they're just not a good fit. We rarely bid on a straight POD print project. We typically just give pricing to a current customer and expect that job will come to us. What we like to consider when we're looking at opportunities, especially web-to-print opportunities, is who's handling the marketing, how large is the addressable customer base, the channel it's going to be sold to, is the solution unique to the market, are we excited about the opportunity, and lastly, I didn't put this in there, but what kind of skin in the game does the client have? If it's, you know, we want to build it and hope they'll come, we shy away from those types of investments, as we have made many, many mistakes in the past of if you build it, they will come.
Hey, Scott, I do have one quick question for you from our audience, and that is, when you look at the fees, and you mentioned, you know, a monthly fee and then a, you know, a declining scale based on print volume, but you're charging up front for the web-to-print site development, and you're developing a statement of work for that, and then collecting the monthly fee thereafter, right?
Yes, yes. That's in, I think that's in the next.
Okay,
I think
sorry.
That's in the next slide, yeah. Oh, no problem.
Okay.
So when we do the pricing and the invoicing, it's typically separated out by the technology side of it and the print and fulfillment side of it. So like I said previously, it's rare that the specs of a new portal or a new web to print build, it's rare that these specs and costs don't change. So we typically bill once milestones are hit. If somebody brings up a change or some kind of scope creep, it's identified immediately. We will rewrite an addendum to the agreement and get everybody's buy-off on that and again, figure out when that payment is going to be paid and the milestone that needs to be reached for that to trigger. So once we start billing on a monthly basis, we list out the print and fulfillment as one line item. It's typically included in that would be some type of metric spreadsheet. And that would be customized for the client based on what they need to see. So they would get one invoice maybe monthly, or they might, if they're a very big customer, they might get a semi-monthly billing so that we have better cash flow. We also have royalty agreements in place. We can't manufacture everything. We know that. We like to go wide, but we just can't do it all. So if we're doing something for a customer that wants us to host the entire store, but they know we can't produce a certain item, we'll push it. We might push a certain number of SKUs to other manufacturers, and we're happy to do that for a small royalty in order to keep it all in one place. And then finally, recommendations. Know the market you're in. It can have a huge influence on your strategy. And know your numbers, variable cost, fixed cost, break-even point. If you're using contribution margin, it's critical that you know whether or not to raise your prices or lower your prices. What happens if I raise my prices 5%? What kind of market share do I lose? You know, go ahead and model that out. Or if I lower my prices, will I gain market share? Model that out as well. What does that do to my contribution margin? So when a customer comes to you and says, "Hey Bob, if you just give me 3% better pricing, I could give you 10% more work." That may be a good thing. It may not be a good thing, but know it, or at least give yourself a chance to analyze it and figure it out. And that pretty much wraps up my presentation. I saved the best for last, or I should say Barb saved the best for last, so I'll turn it over to Val.
Well, I've got one quick question for you, Scott, before we move on, and I'm just going to ask, and you can respond or figure out exactly what the right answer is. But have you got some rule of thumb relative to what the market will bear for building out a web-to-print site, or is that directly correlated to what that statement of work looks like?
Yeah, unfortunately, there is no rule of thumb. We've built sites for under $5,000, and we're about to finish one that's well into the six-figure mark. So it takes a lot of front-end scoping to get it right, and like I said, we rarely... I really should say never. It never comes out exactly as scoped. It would have to be so simple for that to happen. Things just change along the way, and it changes on both sides. So you really need to stay on top of the project, and you really need to have your IT folks involved in the upfront part of the job when you're scoping it out.
Great. Thanks, Scott. And now I am going to turn over to Val DiGiacinto. And what you're going to hear from Val is a little different. Val has spent an inordinate amount of time really getting into some of the more advanced services, things like QR codes. So I'm going to let Val share with you what he's doing in terms of making recommendations on pricing as you move into the more emerging technology side of the business, which is QR, things like QR codes, mobile marketing, and social media. Val, take it away.
Thanks, Barb. I appreciate it. And thanks to both Scotts for setting all of this up. I was thinking about changing my name to Scott DiGiacinto just to make it more confusing. But a little bit about Val DiGiacinto and Partners. I've been in business for over 20 years and been consultant to the industry on a number of different products. And we like to help our clients move into new technology and new marketing technology as well today. We also consult with other printers in the world for helping them to move into these areas as well. When we started in some of the more mobile technology and processes and those that are related to it as well, I really think our focus was going to be on serving a specific industry. We were looking for verticals that we thought would be able to take the market directly straight up for us. And we noticed after several successful campaigns that it really became apparent that these technologies are very wide. They'll fit almost any industry. And if you find the right fit, it's just amazing what kinds of technology these can bring. The first campaigns were local, and based on successes, we're able to bring those to more international and national as well. So the basic process for industries now include virtually everything, from cosmetics to fashion, sports, pharmaceuticals, and it really moves on. I don't think there's a market that it wouldn't fit. One of the things that's very important is getting the first campaign right and then building on those, obviously, when you move forward from there, because one successful campaign will help you to build into the next one. These are some of the services that we provide, and I know as you look at them, it seems like a bunch of stuff that's out there, but without being able to offer a number of services to our clientele, it's really difficult to be able to take a project on and try to control the entire project from start to finish. And when I first started looking at these processes, a friend of mine in the business, Mike Panaggio from DME Graphics, had spoken to me about how they first started in this business, and they were doing some components and some levels of it, but really could never get the full success of the project once they turned the sales portion back over to the client base. And most of it was because it was such new technology in the direct marketing area that it was difficult, I think, for the client side to be able to follow through on some of the basis of what the campaign began. So based on that, his philosophy was to take the entire project. So his go-to-market strategy became not just fulfilling some of the direct marketing campaigns, but also taking it right through, developing call centers, being able to make some guarantees to the client that when they reached their goals, he would be the responsible party, but he wanted to take the responsibility from start to finish. And I think that's the go-to-market strategy as well. I think when you're trying to build new technologies, it's so new to so many customers that unless you try to bring as much as possible in-house, and again, by saying in-house, it doesn't mean that it has to be through your specific company. There's a lot of really good strategic partners out there that can help to make these things come true for you, even if you don't offer those types of services as well. So we can keep incorporating those services once we do become more proficient at the process as well. Now, I borrowed this slide from Barb. Hope you don't mind, Barb. But when you're looking at some of these, I thought this was really a telling slide. As you look at what these answers were from companies who were looking into doing a primary cross-media campaign that involves a lot of the things that we're talking about today, you can take a look at their responses, a lot of it's just about pain points and fear. It's newer technologies, as I mentioned. It's the kind of thing that makes it more difficult to move towards. So I think the clientele base that I've encountered are always looking for help. They're looking to go to my company and other companies for the expertise that we're there to offer because it's new to them. In some cases, they're trying things and have tried things that haven't been successful. And that's when I think we really can hit a home run where we can go in and analyze what they've done and make suggestions that will help to make these things move forward for them as well. But, again, this was a very telling slide to me when I first saw Barb present it in that it really does show how much of the process is new to them, and I think there's a certain fear factor that's involved with it as well. So the most important part is to define objectives when you're going into the process, and I think Scott DuBois hit on that early on. We walk into the client meeting for the first time. It's amazing how difficult this banter can be to try to get to what the objective is. Often it takes a little bit longer in asking the same kinds of questions to really be able to draw out from the client what the actual goal of the campaign is going to be. And that consultative sales process, I think, is something that we've heard. Maybe it sounds like it's a trite term today, but I really believe that it becomes most appropriate when you walk into a client today and you're starting to talk about some of these newer technologies. It also provides some of the value-added concept from you as an expert in the field. They're coming to you and looking to you to be able to offer these kinds of services at a high level, and the expectation is that the price that they're willing to pay is higher because you're bringing that expertise to the table as well. And just like what Scott was saying, once we have an understanding after a meeting or two initially, it's really important to make sure that expectations are on par, and we start that by offering a flow chart to our client that allows us to say that this is what we believe the campaign is going to entail. This is the core part of it that we'll handle and what we're going to focus on, and these are some possible add-ons that might make the campaign even more successful from our perspective. And once that's done, then we do submit a proposal, and that's what our goal is, to maintain that proposal throughout the process. But the ultimate goal is to really get the metrics. That's what we're offering today, and I believe that's what the clients are looking for more than anything, is to be able to take the data that's coming in from these campaigns or the marketing metrics, and then analyze them and develop results from those that allow you to continue the campaign through other value-added services. An example of this is a campaign that recently was out for a company called Elizabeth Arden that has something for Provage that was a process for anti-aging. It's presented to a number of different publications. And again, I think it's the process of being able to look at what the results are, analyze the results, and then move forward from there. The value that you get from those results and the analytics that you're adding to this process is really the part that I believe becomes the most powerful part of the process, but also becomes the most value-added part for the you driving the campaign. Because it can add a lot of other components to it as well, such as email blasts, variable direct marketing, SMS text messaging, and so on. By breaking down and analyzing what each of the results are from various people who are starting to develop trends within those metrics and the analysis, you can provide those kinds of email blasts, variable direct marketing, and so on to those folks in a specific group, changing the message to each of those groups as well. And again, the client can make decisions based on those kinds of metrics that are coming back as well. For example, what publications that they want to renew and maybe highlight in some areas based on the results that they're getting. The importance that Scott also brought up was, Scott DuBois, and I think both of them did, of social media is really critical today. It really becomes part of what the communication tool that we're seeing for so many people in the world today, for sure. And it's not just the demographic of younger people. I think everybody is communicating today through tools like Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn, and just straight emails back and forth to each other. So social media can really bring legacy to campaigns. And again, this is the value that we're looking for, is to try to take something from a client, present a process, be able to build from that, and from there be able to continue the process for a very long period of time. And another example is something that happened back in July of 2010. Some of you may be familiar with that. That was for Calvin Klein, and it was a giant wallscape along with a number of other collateral that were out in different locations in New York and both California. And it was up for a total time of about 3 weeks. After the collateral came down, and mostly due to social media, this process went up into the seven figures, and you can see that 93% part of that pie, after the two-plus years that have gone by at this point, those numbers are mostly coming from social media and continue to come in from social media on a nonstop basis. So it's something that the legacy of social media can continue a process long after the campaign is actually run and expected to continue to run. So it really boils down to the real-time analytics, the results. And again, this is where I think the power of the process really comes to bear, and the reason why pricing becomes not a cost-plus process, but a process of being able to charge for the value that you're bringing to the client themselves. So again, by being able to track campaign results in real time for your clients, to be able to track a number of pieces of information that you can offer to them, to start to develop the analysis of the consumer patterns and data, and view those metrics graphically as well as offering them data as raw data for them to utilize, becomes a very powerful tool. The ultimate goal of all of this is to create a dynamic virtual campaign that can be updated constantly on the fly based on feedback that you're getting from these metrics and then the ultimate analysis of those metrics as well. And to release personalized multi-channel marketing process within a specific time frame, that call to action process that is a result of identifying where these marketing forks are coming from. And just another campaign that just to take a quick look at.
Before you do that, Val, I do have a question from the audience on this one.
Sure.
You talk about real-time analytics, but as you go into the process of delivering, whether it's the Calvin Klein campaign or any other campaign, how do you charge for that the first time around? How do you figure out how do you get the client convinced that it's worth trying and charge for it and make a buck?
Well, you know, often a question that comes back to us in an original meeting might be, what's the value of adding something? What's my return on my investment? If I have an ad in the publication, for example, and I'm going to put a QR code on it. If I have a wallscape and I'm going to put a QR code on it, I'm already paying for these things. I'm already getting some results for it. So what's the return on my investment? And this is I love when that question comes up because it gives us the opportunity to say, you know, that's a great question. But let's take a starting point and let's see where the basis comes from. What's your return on investment now? And that's where I think everybody just stops for a second, looks around at each other, and realizes that there is no baseline for what we're starting from. They don't, as it is right now, when an ad gets into a publication, there is very little information. There are some services out there that can give you some sense of what's happening with that ad. But for the most part, it's not getting the real value of being able to say that there was a QR code, for example, on that particular ad that was added now, and watch the results of what's happening, not just in that publication for that ad, but in all the publications across that particular campaign. And let's really analyze what pubs are working, what pubs aren't, and what are the results and how are they starting to trend. When we can start to see what the analysis is, that cost comes back very quickly. And we're able to share that information up front with the client if they do challenge the process to begin with.
Great. Thanks.
Yep. And this is the last one. Again, this was for a company called Mandy, and it was during last year, during just before Black Friday, and the results were incredible. There was just recently an article out about it, but the poster was up in about 115 stores. It ran the Saturday and Sunday prior to Black Friday. The scan rates were in the tens of thousands. The conversion rate, so from people who scanned it actually used that coupon in store, was over 94%, which is insane when you think about that as a number for actually getting a conversion. But not only that, it allowed the company to continue the campaign further by being able to add those people who responded, the users who actually did use it, to their follow-up email campaigns and other campaigns that are moving forward with it. So I think, again, from the pricing structure, the real concept is not to look at this as a cost plus, but to look at it clearly as being able to offer a campaign from start to finish, allow for some add-ons to be able to be charged additional to those core components. But I think the basis of these campaigns need to be charged as a price, and it needs to be value-based based on what the client's expectations are and what the goals of the campaign are as well. And with that, I think I'm...
Great. Well, thanks, Val. I've got a couple quick questions I'm going to ask, and I'm going to start with one that I got for Scott Feldman. And Scott, the question came in, you know, you're developing sites, but how do you create the perception that you've got increased values when somebody else may say, hey, I can build you a web-to-print site for less?
Yeah, that's typically done by both the salesperson and the sales engineer, if we can get to that introduction step where we're reviewing the scope or the overall project depth. That's where we're gonna shine. And the more complex it is, the more value there is. It's difficult to do, but I think by asking, we have a series of, I believe it's 15 to 20 questions that we ask prospects that want to build a site. And that can lead to much more questions as we ask those questions. They kind of determine that, you know, if it is complex, they start to understand just how complex it is. But typically, to be honest with you, Barb, they've done it before, and the company that tried to do it failed at it. So that's a huge, bonus when you're walking into something and you've heard that and you've heard it a number of times, and you can give examples of how we did this for Company X after they had tried it and couldn't get it done.
Okay, great, thanks. Now this one is for Scott Dubois. Scott, I don't exactly know how you're structured. I know that you're one of the best salespeople out there, but how do salespeople approach the differentiation discussion when they're out prospecting for a new business?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you, Barb, and you are talking to our sole account person. But the way I think about it is it's very rare that, you know, most of what we do is actually business that we identify. And I don't know that probably for this audience that's on this call today, it's probably different. They're, you know, fielding some incoming calls and the like. But, you know, we're probably a smaller company and certainly agency than most of the folks on the call. And so, you know, we're identifying probably three or four new targets every quarter, and that's it that we're going after. And so what we're trying to do is find commonalities, and we'll approach them with where we think we have an opportunity to change their business. And, you know, as part of the sales process, you know, one of the things I'll often talk about if it's a sales-oriented talk that I'm giving is, you know, how you prepare yourself and how you pitch and the amount of research that goes into something. The best thing that can happen as part of that process and differentiation is when you can go in and make a pitch where you've analyzed their business, you think you understand what's going on, you've shown how you can make an impact, and the prospect says to you, well, that's not quite how it is, but let me tell you how it really is. And that's really what we're looking for, because it's achieving or taking the time to go through that effort where it lets you have that next level of discussion. You know, I can't tell you that every time we nail it right out of the gate and we see, you know, what we think we understand is what it actually is. But when you go through that effort instead of just showing up on the doorstep and saying, hey, you know, we're an agency that, you know, we're a multi-channel agency. We can handle everything, you know, from your creative to your media buy, and we'll place television and radio, and, you know, we have the best partnerships, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's commodity driven. It's not that at all. And so when we identify someone, we'll actually go in with a specific idea of a program that we're going to pitch and make a difference in their business.
Well, great. Thanks, Scott. I'm going to just take a second to wrap up. We do have some questions we didn't get to, but we will get back to you in terms of responses. I think what you heard from our participants today, and I want to thank Scott, and Val, is that you want to make sure that you're targeting customers where differentiation can be achieved and where you're at a competitive advantage, and you need to make sure you're calling at the right level. I think we all know today that print alone is a commodity. It's got to be embedded in a value-based solution. And you've got to communicate it in a way that the customers really understand your differentiation. You've got to sell that concept of delivered value, which might be return on marketing investment, reduced inventory cost, enhancement to brand integrity and marketing materials, or even improved service into a dealer channel. And you've got to make sure that your organization is, in fact, focused on both the creation and delivery of value to customers. What you're seeing, and I think you've kind of picked this up from Scott and Val, is that printing companies with the highest profits typically are making complex offerings and delivering value-added solutions. That value and price can be linked to time, discrete features, unique solutions. We also tell everybody to make sure that they're measuring the effectiveness of what they do, testing it and measuring it again. It gives you the ability to consistently, on a regular basis, communicate the value that you're delivering. And most importantly, you want to make sure that you're a strategically important provider. What I'd like to do now is just take a second to thank HP for sponsoring the webinar. HP is also offering a complimentary white paper on pricing. And you can contact, it'll be redirected to registrants. If you'd like, you can also contact HP at 1-800-289-5986. Thanks to everybody. Have a great rest of the day, and a special thanks to our panelists.